Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva's first choice for NPR News.
March 10th marks the 100th anniversary of the death of Eastern Shore hero Harriet Tubman. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Tubman led slaves out of the South through the Underground Railroad, including members of her own family, and brought them to freedom in the North. In her later years, she became part of the suffragette movement, fighting for the right of women to vote. For the next 10 days, the state of Delaware and the counties of Dorchester and Caroline will be marking this historic event, and we'll put a link on our website at www.delmarvapublicradio.net. First, we want to turn to two relatives, Darlene Ross Rogers as well as Pat Ross Hawkins. They are related. They're descendants of Harriet Tubman. And welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, let me ask you, first of all, how are the two of you related to Harriet?
We are related through our grandfather, Owen Ross, as descendants of Ben Ross, Harriet's father. So Harriet is our great-great-great-aunt.
And how did the two of you learn about her? And did your family relate stories about her? Let's start with Pat first.
Yes, they did, but it was like later on. I wasn't aware as a child growing up that I was a descendant. It wasn't until I was actually an adult. But as time passed, you know, I wanted to know as much information as possible. So my two aunts, who both now are deceased, but they were very up on everything, and they told us and shared different stories. They told us that our values were the same as hers in terms of having faith, putting God first, and being supportive of the family and the community. So they told us from that time on that we were people who were born to serve.
Darlene, what about you? What do you remember? When did you first learn about it?
With me, it was about in fourth grade. I have always been an avid reader, and reading about Harriet Tubman, I saw that her name was Ross. And I was like, well, that's my family. So I approached my mom and asked her, I said, well, she's a Ross. Is she related to us? And she said, yes. And then, you know, my grandfather said, yes, she is related, you know, and then they started to relate stories of the family history. What had happened was, because the Ross name was dropped so much from everything, that everyone perceived that her bloodlines wasn't that important, and her married name, Tubman, was most important. So my mom mentioned stories as she was growing up, how the Tubman descendants were honored, but the Ross descendants, who were her blood descendants, were told that they weren't that important. But my grandfather, being a man of honor, said, we all stand on our own name. We don't ride on anyone else's works or activities, but all of us have to present our own story, and all of us have to have our own values, but we definitely were blood-related, and blood is more, you know, was the more closer lines of descendancy.
Darlene, learning about the fact that you're related to Harriet Tubman, did that influence the way, was there an influence, do you think, in terms of how you saw life or how your family saw life, as Pat was mentioning?
Oh, yes. It helped to explain how our values were so similar, how that Cambridge, Maryland, all those areas that she traveled, those were areas that we grew up, played in, walked in. Our family is still there today. But those values, those core values that she learned from Ben Ross and Harriet Ross Green, those values of Harriet Green Ross, those values, what has been transferred through our family. Our family is definitely a family dedicated in service, love of God first, love of family, love of community, love of country. And those values are values that we take with us no matter how dispersed we are out of the country, all over the country, all of us have those same values.
Now, you obviously you grew up in the Eastern Shore, and I believe Pat's still there. Are there any particular places that she was there that are special to you, or because there are a lot of places that mark her significance in history?
Oh well, my gracious! Anything that's on the underground byways, all of that is very significant because that's where her footprints were. So that all makes a difference. It's just amazing. I just wanted to just go down to the area where the Bucktown store is. And just from that location, I have gotten out of my car and been in that area at night. And it is a very, very dark, dark place. And I definitely would not want my car to break down and have to walk from there back to Route 50. I don't even believe I have the capabilities of doing such a thing today. So, yes, that's definitely... That strikes out because that's where I first got out and looked around my surroundings and actually was there while it was dark, and it was scary, and it was just not a good place, not for me. I don't know where she got the courage, the strength to do it, but that's an amazing woman.
It's hard to imagine the area because we now have lots of roads and lots of lights. Back then, there weren't lots of roads and lots of lights. I mean, it must have been very scary, especially as somebody was mentioning the other day that here's a woman who, when she led slaves out, she had all this stuff in her head. She didn't have it written down because, of course, she didn't know how to read or write, which must have been an amazing experience. Let me finally ask you, what do you think her legacy is, particularly to the world at large? I mean, how do you see her legacy relating to our world today?
What I say is our family, this is what we've all been passing down from generation to generation, starting with my grandfather. And that is that no matter what someone may say, you can or cannot do, you must first see it, see yourself successful, believe that you can be successful, and then you can achieve it. So in other words, if you see yourself successful and believe it, then you can achieve it. And that's what the world needs to know today, is that's how we can overcome some of the obstacles that we now face today. So
we've been speaking with Darlene Ross Rogers as well as Pat Ross Hawkins, and they are descendants of Harriet Tubman. And we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
And we now want to, by the way, go to Dr. Clara Small. She's a professor of history at Salisbury University and has been deeply involved in the celebration, especially as a historian of the famed Underground Railroad. Well, I want to sort of move back here in time. And at the time that Tubman was born, which is somewhere, I guess, around 1820, we're not quite sure. But
1820 or 1821,
yeah.
We're not sure.
What was the Eastern Shore like at that point?
Oh, my goodness. Oh. It had changed in terms of the economy to mostly grains, wheat, things of that nature, because tobacco had simply petered out by that time. There was quite a bit of divisiveness, sometimes even between families. Because some individuals were free and as slaves, others were not. But there was also a man here around 1855, Curtis Jacobs, who wanted to make sure that his slaves did not escape anymore. So he would send some of them to Arkansas and simply, I guess you could say, not necessarily sell them, but apprentice them out to others to make money. And he also went before the Maryland legislature to try to re-enslave free blacks. So it was a strange situation. And the Eastern Shore was always divided. Some individuals believed in slavery. Others tried to free their slaves. So it was a strange time.
Now, when she was born, give some sense about the kind of family she was born into. And the sense I get, by the way, is that she was often hired out by her owner. And that seems to be where she got really almost the worst kind of beatings, the worst kind of brutality she saw. Tell me a little bit about that process.
Well, that process was that some owners did not have enough chores or work for some slaves to do. So they would hire them out to other people, much like an apprenticeship, and she would have to work and be paid for that. No, she would not be paid. Sorry, her owner.
Right.
And she was not a good slave. She definitely was not. Her father was a free man, but her mother was a slave. Even though there are records in the Patterson will which states that her mother was supposed to have been freed during a certain time, but Harriet would still have been a slave because she would have been born before her mother was freed. To hire someone out sometimes was the worst thing that could happen because in many instances, Harriet would be standing in water knee-deep sometimes because she was supposed to be capturing muskrats and other animals and beaten severely sometimes and would often be told to do certain jobs, but not the instructions on how to do it. Harriet was not a good slave until she started working with her, and still not a good slave, working with her father in the lumberyard. She worked the same as the men did. She was not a huge lady. She was rather petite.
Right, about 5 foot, I think, is what
yes,
I've seen, yeah.
Yes. So, but she did the same labor as a man by working with her father, which also gave her an opportunity to learn about the wilderness, woodlands, and things of that nature. So she learned how to work with nature. And that's what helped her to survive. And whenever she became ill, she would be sent back to her mother so that her mother could take care of her. And then as soon as she was well, out in the fields again, or to be hired out by to someone. Didn't matter. The idea was to get money.
All right. I mean, I guess there's a quote of hers in which she says, I grew up like a neglected weed,
yes.
Ignorant of liberty, having no experience of it. And yet, despite all of that, she yearns to be free.
She yearns to be free because Maryland had more free blacks than any other state at that point in time. And she had come in contact with a lot of free individuals. So to see someone else who was of your same color who was free, you would desire to be free as well. And by coming in contact with those individuals, that desire was there. And she married a free black man, John Tubman. But the lore is that every time she talked about getting her freedom, he threatened to tell her owner. Oh, yes.
Why did he do that?
Well, if she had escaped while being married to him, he would have been suspect in helping her to escape. And anyone who tried to help slaves escape were suspect, and they could be punished. And he did not want that.
Now, there's an incident that occurs in which she gets injured at the store.
Yes.
She's hit. Tell me a little bit about how that incident unfolded, because it was actually involving what appeared to be, anyway, a slave who
was attempting to escape.
He certainly was. I think it was put it as he had left the fields without permission, I think was the term. Tell me a little bit about how that came about.
Well, she was rather nosy as teenagers during that point in time. So she saw this slave who had left the fields and was going through the store. And so the slave driver, the person in charge, was trying to enlist her help. But instead she got in between the slave that they thought was trying to escape and the slave driver. And when through a weight, it hit her in the head. And she that dent in her forehead remained until her death. That's why you generally see her with a scarf.
Hmm.
And it's believed that it may have led to narcolepsy or sleeping sickness. And she would fall asleep at any point in time. She could be working, fall asleep. She could be talking to you. And when she'd come out of it, and there was no telling when that would happen, she would just continue where she had left off. And so it took a long time for her to recover from that.
It also led to, I understand, to strange dreams, visions,
yes.
which as I understand, as I read the history, is that about this time she also becomes fairly religious. I mean, these
yes.
two things seem to happen simultaneously.
Oh, yes. And she knew that her owner wanted to sell her as well as members of her family because some of them had already been sold away from them. So she wanted to be well, but at the same time, she wanted to her owner to heal his cold heart. Okay, so it didn't. She prayed. She began to pray that his heart would change. That didn't happen. So she prayed, let him die. He did die. So she thought, oh, maybe there's something to this. But she did become quite religious during that time.
And one of the things that, as I read, that when she read the religious texts, she obviously rejected what essentially was a white interpretation, which was a slave master interpretation, which was that you're supposed to be obedient as a slave. She really found, it seems, a message in particularly the Old Testament in deliverance.
Yes, but she did not learn to read or write.
Right.
That's what she wanted to do. She wanted to do that more than anything else. Even on the Underground Railroad, when she ended up in Philadelphia with William Steele, who also has quite a few connections here on the Eastern Shore, William Steele, writing in his book Underground Railroad, talks about the different things that she would do and how he was able to help her along with Thomas Garrett up in Wilmington. But she never learned to read nor write, but the desire was there. And it is, I believe we have a record whereby she was helping to raise money for some schools for blacks. Harriet Tubman desired freedom more so than anything else. But when she volunteered to become a part of the Underground Railroad, she knew that she could not read nor write, so she memorized the routes. And when some of the routes were compromised, she had to memorize some others. And the slaves that she would take to freedom never knew where the next stop on the next station was on the Underground Railroad. They never knew where they were going to be able to get food or anything of that nature. She knew it, but they didn't. And when they became afraid and turned back, she had to go back and find them again. And that was also true when she went into, you know, that narcolepsy. And she never lost the one. Can you imagine being on the route with Harriet Tubman? She's leading you through swamps, through fields, through forests, and you name it. And she's the only one who knows the route. And she falls asleep. You don't know where you're going. If you were a slave, generally, you would not go off of your plantation or venture very far. And you had to have a pass to give you permission to do so. And she's the only one who knows the route. So every time she go into that strange state, she would have to find those slaves. And she never lost one. I call that some type of divine intervention.
Now, also, by the way, I just said that she did carry a gun when she
yes.
was when she, and there's a one incident in which she I think she tells us a story about the one slave who wanted to go back, and she sort of points the gun at his head and says, "Well, you know, either go on or you die." I mean, she
yes.
was very tough about this.
Right, dead slaves tell no stories. But there was an incident in Dover, the Dover incident, whereby some slaves did escape. And one slave, after he got away, he was lonesome for his family. He came back and started asking questions. And if a slave or someone who was strange and out of his element started asking questions, it meant that something was wrong. 9 times out of 10, he was a slave. It compromised the route, so they had to change it.
Now, tell me a little bit about the first time that she decided to, she actually escaped. Because actually there was one attempt with her brothers.
With
and
her
then,
brothers, yes.
And
but they became afraid.
Yeah.
And so they turned back. And she turned back too. But then she hid out in the pig pen for about 3 days, and that was enough of dirt and grime with the pig. So she went back, took her punishment, and it was at that point that she decided that she would have to escape on her own. And so she did. In 1849. And that's when she went to Philadelphia. Some records state that she went to Cape May. But the job, and she began to work, but she could only work on menial jobs because she could not read nor write. But she saved money, and she found out about William Steele in Philadelphia, and she volunteered to work with them.
Now, what kind of route, then, was she taking as she brought these slaves through? I mean, if we were driving, say, for instance, the Eastern Shore or even in Delaware, what areas would we might wind up meeting her, as it were, if we were back then? I mean, what?
That's hard to say because sometimes they would have to alter it and travel mostly during the night. As one of my students said in the class one time, Route 13? Just kidding. No, not really. But sincerely, she would have to vary the routes according to circumstances. We don't know all of the routes. We only know some possible routes, but it's hard to say.
Yeah, because I know that, and as a matter of fact, she didn't really talk too much about that or the people who helped her until after, long after.
Because they would have been, they would have gone to prison because they were basically stealing property. And after 1850, the year after she escaped, the Fugitive Slave Law was passed. And it was a requirement for every person who helped slaves to escape. They would be fined or they would go to jail because they were basically stealing property. And slaves were definitely property. Slaves were more assets than anything else on the plantations. Even for small planters, slaves were profits.
By the way, I understand this, and reading particularly about slavery in the South as recently, is that there were a lot of runaway slaves. I mean, there was constant. I mean, this was a constant thing. This was not something that just happened every once in a while, but that it happened a lot.
A lot, because there were numerous reasons for slaves to escape. One was separation from families, not being allowed to see family members or your wife, the threat of being sold south, being beaten severely. So some slaves simply said, why not escape? Anything's better than this. And so there are numerous advertisements. As a matter of fact, I believe that the Maryland State Archives is having a display or exhibit on runaways. And they have also worked out some plays about slaves that escaped. And more we're finding records of individuals who did escape and began to tell those stories. I think one of the best examples of that would be Henry Box Brown out of Richmond, who boxed himself up into a little tiny box and had himself shipped to Philadelphia. And in Richmond, when I was up at UVA one summer, I tried to fit myself into that little box. No, that wouldn't work for me. I'm too tall. And then there's Ellen Craft and her husband, she was very fair. Her husband was dark. They were owned by different people. And she made a uniform for her husband, and he was supposed to play the part of her servant. And she dressed as a man. So they took a carriage from the owner, and they escaped. Then they got on a train, and to make sure that they would not be found out, handkerchief was put around her face, and the slave said that, Master is ill. We must get to New York or Philadelphia to a doctor. So she never had to say anything. And her arm was in a sling. So that every time they went to a hotel, they said, well, Master's arm is broken, you know. So they got away that way, out of Georgia.
By the way, I understand that Harriet Tubman, who came back to the Eastern Shore, ran into, I don't know, is somebody who had formerly known her.
Yes.
And at one point, as we point out, she was illiterate, but she decided to pick up a newspaper to read it.
And didn't know whether it was right side up or upside down.
Right. But nonetheless, because Harriet Tubman, or people they were looking for, was not supposed to be able to read.
That's right. And another time, someone else saw her, and she had some chickens, but she let the chickens go, and so they scattered. So everybody, you know, were trying to find, capture the chickens, so she was able to get away. She may not have been able to read nor write, but she was smart. She had mother wit, common sense, which was fantastic.
She said that, and I was curious about this. There's a lot of discussion about coded messages between slaves, and I mean, obviously the famous one is from her. She's singing to a trusted slave, in which she says, "I'll meet you in the morning. I'm bound for the promised land." How ever present, or how much was that kind of code used, do you think, at that period of time in which people would sing, or there would be other indications as to other slaves who might, for instance, have escaped, and as they near, say, a plantation or an area, there would be some indication as to whether or not it was safe, not safe. How much of that was used? Do we know yet?
Well, from individuals who were interviewed during that time, those messages were very prevalent during that time. And someone said that quilts were used, but I'm not sure about that. Okay. I had one of my students to make a quilt, which was one of her projects. But the thing is, it's not very... Most historians do not find credibility in the quilts anymore.
Hmm.
But it sounds great. But the other thing is that slaves were like, very similar to, I should say, getting messages. They were very good at getting messages across to each other. And they would simply pass the word along. It's like an old refrigerator. They didn't keep anything. They kept passing it along. But that was their, they had very good communication on the plantations and across plantations so that word could be spread very easily.
I want to turn to John Brown. Obviously, the raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859, which, of course, he was later on hanged for it. What do we know about Harriet Tubman's involvement? On the one hand, I read that she was certainly involved with recruitment. On the other hand, she was not around when it took place. What do you make of that?
Well,
I mean, I guess, you know.
She, John Brown wanted to recruit her. But at the time of the raid, she was supposed to have been ill. And Harriet, from all indications that I have, that she thought it was a great idea, but she didn't think it was workable. Frederick Douglass, he tried to recruit Frederick Douglass, too. But when Frederick Douglass and John Brown met in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, people began to realize, okay, that's Frederick Douglass. So he had to back out because he was too visible. He tried to recruit Henry Holland Garnett, who's also from the Eastern Shore and also a relative of Frederick Douglass. Garnett wanted to, but Garnett did not see that it would be workable. So he was in touch, John Brown was in touch with a lot of individuals, and a lot of individuals recruited individuals to help him. But the major individuals such as Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Henry Highland Garnett were not there when the raid started. It was a plan not just to steal guns, but it was also a plan to recruit poor whites, okay, who were not a part of the slaveocracy, but also free blacks and slaves to help him. And there were some free blacks who did help John Brown. And we even have a record of their books telling their side of the story. So it's slavery takes on many views. It is not as simplistic as it appears. It is not as complex as many people tried to make it, because there were kinship ties between individuals. And kinship ties did not mean blood relations. Many individuals supported John Brown as well. There was there were individuals known as the Secret Six who gave their money and helped to support John Brown. Yeah. So slavery is very, very interesting, but it's also complex in some instances, but it's also simplistic as well. And there were some free blacks who owned a lot of slaves, too.
Well, that's true, as a matter of fact. Although, this, for the historical record, almost all of them were white. But that's, you know, slave owners. We just want to make sure that it's clear. Let me turn to the Civil War, because what's interesting is that she takes on this sort of prominent role leading the raid, and we can talk a little bit about that. But she becomes deeply involved with the Civil War. But she's also very critical, at least early on, of Lincoln, who is not freeing the slaves. As a matter of fact, there was some incident with one of his generals. Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. She was very involved in the Civil War with recruitment. She was involved in the sense that she was a cook for the Union Army. She was a nurse, a spy, and a scout. She led a military campaign in Cumberhee, South Carolina. And she freed 756 slaves in that campaign. And she gained quite a bit of respect. Now, here's the thing. She was critical of Lincoln. And later in life, she said that she was sorry she did not go to meet him. Sojourner Truth met Lincoln. And when Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth met, they talked about that. Harriet and Lincoln were on different sides. See, Lincoln was a compromiser. Lincoln was willing to do whatever was necessary to save the Union. That's his goal. That's his goal no matter what. And he straddled the fence at other times. But one of Lincoln's generals, Fremont, was freeing slaves. Lincoln told Fremont, stop. He ordered him not to. Other generals were freeing slaves left and right. Lincoln basically began to catch up with his generals. And so in September, around September the 22nd, he issued the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. And it gave the Confederacy 100 days, precisely 100 days, to come back into the Union. And most people thought, oh, Lincoln freed the slaves. Not really. Not one slave was free, because Lincoln was freeing slaves in territory he did not control. And if you cannot and do not control territory, you can't free anyone. And that also included the areas not affected by, included Accomack and Northampton counties. So the Emancipation Proclamation looked good on paper, but it was also used as a military strategy to keep England and France from assisting the Confederacy, because England and France needed cotton. So using cotton diplomacy, Lincoln said, okay, we'll just take the moral high road and free slaves.
And we were speaking with Dr. Clara Small. She's a history professor here at Salisbury University, also deeply involved in the celebration for Harriet Tubman, and also a famed historian for the Underground Railroad. She'll also be featured speaker at the Harriet Tubman Banquet on Saturday, March 9th at the Governor's Hall at Sail Winds Park in Cambridge. And in the first part of our program, we had Darlene Ross Rogers and Pat Ross Hawkins, both descendants of Harriet Tubman. This is Don Rush, and you've been listening to Delmarva Today, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.